Okay, next presentation is variation in anthocyanin production among session and cultivar for rock bluegrass. The presentation will be given by Dominica Petrillo at Iowa State University.
All right, good afternoon, and thank you. So I'll just start off by saying that this research is definitely a little bit different than what you've seen today. So I would just like to inspire everybody to think outside the box for the next 12 minutes, okay? So the rationale behind this research is that anthocyanins are in extremely high demand. They're a commodity, and they keep increasing in value. What they're used for? Natural food colorants, natural beverage colorants. They're currently being used in nutraceutical or functional food type products. Furthermore, they're being looked at as treatments for cancer, heart disease, and namely, they're basically looking at them for diseases or cures or treatments for diseases all across the board. What's the problem then? Currently, there's only a few number of species that are used to actually extract or harvest these secondary metabolites, namely fruits and vegetables, where the number of species is somewhere around 10. The question is then, as demand further increases, how are you going to actually meet that demand using that number of species? Then the question becomes, is turfgrass the answer for actually harvesting and extracting these types of compounds? Interesting enough, rough bluegrass Apoa trivialis meets the majority of the criteria necessary to serve as a source of anthocyanin production. Most people in here probably know this species as being a weed, primarily because of low tolerance to environmental stress. Also, most people should know that it actually produces anthocyanins constituently. A purple sheath is actually a key identification feature for this plant. The idea is then, can we combine these two factors, the low stress tolerance and the known ability to produce anthocyanins, to actually force this plant to increase production? The answer is yes. Previous research that I performed using the cultivar Havana showed that under light stress, this species could actually upregulate anthocyanin production upwards of 12,000%. Okay, that was 12,000%. So prior to treatment, you would have a nice, normal, healthy plant. After light stress, you would get basically a purple to a red plant that would contain upwards of 200 milligrams per 100 grams of anthocyanin per tissue. However, the question became then, is this normal for the species? Or is this unique to this particular cultivar? And essentially, that was the purpose of this study, to evaluate and determine if there was variation for anthocyanin production within the Poa trivialis species. So how did I do this? I evaluated 19 accessions and 5 historical cultivars that I all obtained from the Western Regional Plant Introduction Station. Accessions range from pretty much all over the world: Afghanistan, Iran, Morocco. Cultivars consist of the oldest cultivar, rough bluegrass, Polis, and then Saber, Laser, Pro-Am, Colt, and then again the cultivar Havana. To me, the most interesting part about these accessions and the cultivars to begin with was the morphological diversity. Some were indistinguishable from Kentucky bluegrass, many produced rhizomes, and then you had the normal rough bluegrass fine textured varieties. So this led to the hypothesis for the study. With so much morphological diversity, that we would see a similar diversity for actual anthocyanin production. So how did I actually increase anthocyanin production in these plants? Treatment consisted of exposure to blue light. Why blue light? Blue light is a known inducer for anthocyanin-related genes. So you apply blue light, and you have a known treatment for increasing anthocyanin production. Specifically, I used blue LEDs with a wavelength of 472 nanometers. Those LEDs arrays that you see replace 5 centimeters from the top of the canopy, where light intensity is approximately 450 micromoles per meter squared per second. All plants are then exposed to 24 hours a day of this blue light for a total time span of 7 days, and they are in a growth chamber set to 15 degrees Celsius. You may ask, why so long? Essentially, it was to produce the maximum amount of anthocyanins possible, to see the full potential. Then going into experimental design, because I had 25 accessions, I had to set this up as an incomplete block design. Each experiment was split up into 4 runs, where each run consisted of 6 to 7 of those 25 accessions. Again, One experiment was made up of four runs. The experiment was then repeated two times, both times in separate growth chambers. And in between experiments, all accessions or cultivars are vegetatively propagated into new soil. Then to analyze the incomplete block design, SAS 9.2 and the mixed procedure was implemented. So what about materials and methods? The primary material method used for this study was determination of total monomeric anthocyanin concentration. For harvesting, following treatment, all tissue 1.5 centimeters above the rim of the pot was harvested, snap frozen in liquid nitrogen, and then lyophilized for 24 to 48 hours. Then following freeze drying, tissue was ground to a powder in liquid nitrogen, extracted in acetone, and then polar and nonpolar compounds were separated using a chloroform separation. So following separation, you can see a distinct layering effect where that top layer is your aqueous layer containing anthocyanins. That layer was partitioned off and then used for actual quantification using the pH differential method. Further on in the study, I also implemented supplementary methods, namely scanning electron microscopy, where tissue is preserved using the critical point drying technique, coated in 0.2 kiloangstrom platinum, and then the resulting micrographs were actually used for measurements in Adobe Photoshop. Total cuticular wax was also determined, where all tissue again was harvested 1.5 centimeters above the rim of the pot, and then extracted in chloroform for 15 seconds. That resulting extract is then used in a potassium dichromate colorimetric method for wax content determination. I also looked at total phenolic and flavonoids prior to blue light treatment and 48 hours into blue light treatment. Phenolics were evaluated using the Follens phenol reagent colorimetric method, and flavonoids using the aluminum chloride colorimetric method. Also to note then, all these supplementary methods are performed on four replicates with multiple subsamples per replicate. So going into the results then, it's fairly clear there is a large amount of variation for anthocyanin production among those 25 accessions and cultivars that I looked at. That picture you see right there is a single cultivar from Germany, and this was an ideal reaction going from basically less than a milligram of anthocyanins per 100 gram to about 60 milligrams per 100 grams. And this is what I would consider for this experiment a high concentration. And then one thing to note then, there really was only a handful of species that were able to produce what I would consider high concentrations of anthocyanins. This consisted of all the cultivars, including Havana, minus Polis, and two natural accessions. Interestingly enough, both accessions were from Germany. Further insight into this 95% confidence interval really determines how things separated out. When you look at it, what stands out are a low producing group and a high producing group that are both significantly different from one another, and a transition group that isn't significantly different from either. Not only are they connected by the amount of anthocyanins they are producing, but they also can be distinguished by their morphology. That low group consisted of coarse textured accessions, while the high group consisted of 100% fine textured accessions. So I wasn't happy enough just seeing that variation. I really wanted to determine ultimately what was responsible for that variation, what was causing it, or at least to get an idea of what was causing it. So further studies that I went on were looking to see if it was morphology, physiology, or some combination of the two. For morphology, I evaluated mesophyll thickness and total cuticular wax content, thinking that alterations in these two parameters would ultimately result in differential variation in the absorption, reflection, or concentration of light within the leaf. And then physiology, the idea is, looking at precursor to anthocyanins, phenolics, and flavonoids, how do their concentrations ultimately affect anthocyanin content? Do the accessions producing high concentrations of anthocyanins have constituently high levels of precursors? Are they able to upregulate these precursors at a faster rate? Looking at the first parameter, mesophyll thickness then, what stood out was, first to note, I looked at 4 out of 10 accessions on this. So correlations couldn't be made, but trends were still visible. Looking at this bar chart with accessions on the X, and then measurable thickness in micrometers on the Y. What stands out, these two bars on the left, both being significantly, having a significantly thicker mesophyll, also had significantly lower concentrations of anthocyanins. The two bars on the right were both accessions or cultivars producing high concentrations of anthocyanins. They had a significantly thinner mesophyll. The theory is, if you look into it, is that it's all about light trapping. And the idea is a thinner mesophyll layer will actually result in higher concentrations or higher gradients of light within the leaf. And that's the theory looking at differences in mesophyll thickness. However, then, looking at totocuticular wax content, there was a clear and significant correlation that higher wax content would lead to lower concentrations of anthocyanins. Looking at this top left plot with totocuticular wax on the X in micrograms per centimeter squared and total anthocyanin content on the Y in milligrams per 100 grams, there is an R-squared of 0.4187. It is fairly low, but at 95%, it was significant, having a p-value of 0.0431. Again, I looked at totocuticular wax content on a canopy level. I didn't evaluate individual leaves of the same age or the same composition, which basically leads me to the idea of this is why I have a low R-squared, but it's still significant, showing that high concentrations of wax somehow alter and actually probably increase blue light reflection, decreasing blue light perception, and leading to decreased anthocyanin production. So what are the effects of precursors, phenolics and flavonoids? Prior to treatment, there's absolutely no correlation between the concentration of phenolics and flavonoids to total anthocyanin production. Even accessions in cultivars that had low concentrations of anthocyanins following treatment had high concentrations of phenolics and flavonoids prior to treatment. So some have said maybe we can exogenously apply precursors or upregulate precursors to increase anthocyanin production, where in this case, that really isn't the case. Physiology here is kind of, I wouldn't say being a negative aspect, but it definitely isn't increasing anthocyanin production. Then what about phenolics and flavonoids 48 hours into treatment? So these plants were exposed to 48 hours of blue light to see if phenolic and flavonoid content somehow increased at a faster rate for certain accessions. Again, there is absolutely no correlation with increasing phenolics and flavonoids with increasing anthocyanin content. Both of these bar charts show accessions on the X and then increase in phenolics on the Y, or increase in flavonoids on the Y. And there's a large diversity in the ability to actually increase phenolics and flavonoids, where some of the accessions up towards the top, 20, 5, all had low ability to produce anthocyanins, but they are upregulating phenolic and flavonoid content by a high percentage. So in essence, this negates the idea of alteration in light perception to some degree, being that these plants are perceiving light. However, they're probably just producing other compounds rather than phenolics and flavonoids. They may not be producing anthocyanins, but they're producing some sort of compound due to blue light. In conclusion then, anthocyanin production vary greatly. It's due to both morphology and physiology, where both are necessary to produce high concentrations of anthocyanin, precise morphology and a precise physiology. What this variation then suggests is that we can actually breed a variety to specifically to produce anthocyanins. Future investigations, I'm also going to be looking at what those low-producing accessions are producing. Are they producing phenolics and flavonoids that are in demand? Or are they producing phenolics and flavonoids that have a potential in the market? That's all I have. I follow up any questions. Thank you.
Francis?
Yes?
So practically speaking, the idea is that eventually we'll grow top bluegrass to produce anthocyanin.
Correct.
It is from fruits and vegetables.
Correct.
One more question.
Do you know if the accessions, the ones that in particular were intermediate,
Yeah.
And the high ones, in addition to Germany, do they tend to be high latitude or northern environments where they would have kind of a beneficial effect on the anthocyanin accumulation?
There wasn't any trend with that. It was all over the place, the ones in the transitions. Being from Afghanistan, Iran, it did not matter.
What kind of economic impact does this have? How much demand is there for this?
Billions of dollars. Currently, anthocyanins sell on the open market for $100 a milligram. And this is from a company that sells them directly to the pharmaceutical industry. So there is a high demand from multiple markets, and that's what really makes it such a benefit. It's not just one market that's looking for them.